Welcome back to Stack Trace, a show where we talk about Apple news from a developer's perspective. And as always, I'm Gui Rambo with my best friend, John Sandel. How are you doing, John?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. I hear that you've been hard at work on doing your first ever sale for Chibi Studio.
Yes. So we have had a little event recently, which people usually used to do like sales of products.
Yeah, something small, right? Very like non-significant.
yeah. A little thingy. And then I talked to my colleague, which does Chibi Studio with me, because I couldn't draw those cute characters by myself. In fact, I can't draw at all, so I have a partner in this project. And we decided to try out a little sale. So we have one of the packs that you can purchase in the app. Gives you access to like everything. So it's a one-time $20 purchase, and you get everything unlocked forever. And we release new content all the time, and you get everything, basically.
And this is the first time you've done a sale, right?
Yes, it's first time ever. So we decided to try it out, but we wanted to try something else as well. We wanted to promote the sale in the app itself, because we try to not be like those scammy apps that pop-up dialogues all the time trying to make you purchase stuff. So we just like show all the items in the library, and the ones that are have to be purchased have a clear indication that they are premium. So you tap them if you want to, and you purchase if you want to, and we don't we try to avoid dark patterns, if you will. So we decided to do a little promotional like splash thing, and with a little animation and a cute icon for the premium pack. And so I can tell you that we did sell a little bit more than usual, but it wasn't like amazing, but it was worth it, I think. It's still ongoing because it's Monday and it ends tonight, so we'll see after today is over and when the numbers come up tomorrow. But yeah, I think it was worth it. And there was an interesting technical aspect if you want to dig into it a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
So I didn't want to just make a one-time thing. I wanted to make, like a good programmer, I wanted something that could be reused in the future.
Let's platformize this.
Of course. Yeah. So I decided to put a little JSON file on my server. And this JSON file has a list of promotions. And each promotion has a start date, an end date. And it has several other properties. We can even like link the API in the show notes if people want to check it out.
Nice.
So it's really cool, actually, because of course, I had many components ready for the app to do this. I didn't build this from scratch in the client side. And server side, it's just a static JSON file that I added by hand. So there's nothing like super clever there. But this is a cool dynamic way of like showing UI in the app, and it can be used for like promotions or if there's like an important update that we need to tell our users about. And I can even like customize the background color, the text color, and the title summary, call to action. And there's a little node for which product is going to be purchased if the user taps the button. And if there's no product, it's not a promotion. It's just a splash screen. So yeah, I'm very happy about it.
Yeah, that sounds really awesome. I think for these kind of things, it's usually worth going that extra mile and making things dynamic. Because, you know, when you're setting up something like a sale or a promotion, or if there's some event that happens or something like that, you usually want to be able to push that without requiring client updates, right? So you don't want the user, I mean, in this case, you did have that dependency. You needed the user to update the app before the promotion would appear because, you know, this was the first time you did it. But the next time, let's say you come up with a new promotion and you just want to launch that straight away, you could do that now because you have this dynamic system set up. And I think having the client draw as much information as possible without causing, you know, unnecessary latencies, of course. But to draw as much as information as possible from the backend and react dynamically to that is just a really good position to be in, because it gives you so much freedom to control things from the server side.
Yeah, and this is, of course, a very low priority thing for the user. So I try to keep it as small as possible. The payload itself is less than a kilobyte. And I think I even set it up so it won't load in cellular connection, only on Wi-Fi.
Oh, that's very considerate of you.
yeah, because we don't want to like spend the user's data for like to just promote something about the app. We want users to have fun. And I even use a little technique, which I mentioned in my last article. So if you look at the splash screen that appears, and there's a little video on my Twitter feed, if you want to check it out, it shows a little animation of the icon for the pack. So Apple now has this concept of each in-app purchase has an icon.
Yeah.
But I made a little animated version of that icon. And
of course you did.
Yeah, of course. And it comes from the server as well. So
it's
a little car animation. Yeah, car animation archive. And it comes from the server. And it's downloaded and rendered in the app. And there's even a little property telling the app how long the animation is, so it can sync up the buttons and text animations with the actual car animation.
Ooh, that sounds really cool. That's, I think, is a kind of an underestimated value of these car files. Like, whenever you mention them that, you know, you can archive a core animation and actually just unarchive it on the, you know, at runtime and actually display it, you know, sometimes people say, you know, what's the point of that? You know, you can just code that in the app and it just works. Well, here you have a very, very good use case where you can actually dynamically download a core animation file, which is a native animation, and actually run it at full performance on the client side completely dynamically, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, otherwise you'd have to use like a video file, which is not vector. So you'd have to either have like a huge resolution video to make sure it works for even the largest device sizes, keeping in mind that this app supports iPad as well. So I would have to keep that in mind and have like a huge video file. And so car animation works great, and you can download executable codes, can, but you really can't. So it's interesting because this can be used for anything that can be like archived with keyed archiver and unarchived with keyed unarchiver. You can take advantage of it. And of course, it's the same thing as like storing a JSON file and using Codable. It's just a little bit more advanced because it actually becomes a core animation layer tree.
Yeah, exactly. And then you can put that, you know, wherever you need to. And you can also have that interact with your views in a whole different way that a video couldn't, for example, right? Because a video is not interactive. And if you have those write events set up on the client side, or if you have that metadata in there to say like, this is tappable, and whenever the user taps this, this should happen. You know, it could kind of continue pulling this thread and actually end up with something really, really cool and very dynamic.
Yeah, and you can also like traverse the layer tree and change stroke colors and fill colors and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really cool. Awesome. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I love doing those kind of projects. And, you know, sometimes it can seem a little bit maybe like over-engineering when you just need to solve a concrete problem, like you wanted to do a sale. But, you know, setting these things up and doing it in a more dynamic way not only kind of future-proofs the solution, but it's also, you know, fun to do that. And I think that's important to remember, especially for these types of projects that we're doing kind of on the side, you know, to have some fun with it and to use it as a learning opportunity as well to say like, you know, could I download this car file and actually do it this dynamic way? Well, maybe I can. Let's try it out. And, you know, sometimes you get really surprised and delighted with the result you achieve.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word delight. This was like my main goal. It wasn't like, oh, I want to make something cool for myself. It was like, okay, we are going to do this promotion and we are going to show a splash screen. How do I make it as cool as possible to the user? Try and delight the user. Even if the user does not want to buy it, they will at least see a cute little animation and they can just say no thanks.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just like a UI alert, right? That just pops up and hey, please buy this. Click buy. Yeah. You know, I think that's a good approach.
And how about you? What have you been doing?
So I've been working really hard lately on a new project. And this project is something I've been wanting to do for a while. And I've actually kind of worked on it on and off for a couple of months at least. But I've kind of switched directions a little bit lately. And the project is that I get a lot of requests almost every single day from people who read my site, who listen to this podcast or my other podcast, Swift by Sundell. To create some kind of examples of the techniques that I talk about, but in a kind of real context. So in the context of a real app. So I've been thinking a lot lately about how this could, you know, how I could do something like this. And I've been working now on an app, which is going to be fully open sourced. So it's going to be available on GitHub, the whole app, and everyone's going to be able to see how I build apps and how I use some of these different techniques in context. And I think this is going to be really cool because not only do I think it's a pretty cool app that I'm building, but also I've been able to use like so many of the techniques I've been talking about in a very nice way. And I think that it will provide a lot of value for people who want to get that kind of extra context. And also for me, whenever I get questions about something, like about one of my articles, for example, I'll be able to point to this app and say, you know, have a look at this. You know, here's an example of how it's used in a real situation. So yeah, I think this is going to be really exciting. And I'm hoping to get this open source before the end of the year.
Yeah, I have some stuff in the real world that I can point people to. Like many times someone will ask me about some macOS API. How do I change the thing on the ENS button so the user clicks it and right click or something. And I can just like find a file in my WWDC app project and just link to it. So here it is. Just have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as someone who creates like a lot of content, having that, you know, extra example is super valuable, right?
And it's not feasible for you to do like one example for each thing you do, because then you wouldn't be able to write an article per week.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, you know, sometimes it is easy to learn about a specific concept, just learning about that concept or that technique, not seeing it, you know, in a whole big Xcode project or something like that. So I still do believe that I think the best format for me, both in terms of, you know, feasibility that I do write every single week, but also for, you know, just for the format itself and, you know, for the articles to be as good as they can be, I think it makes a ton of sense to have these more isolated examples. But I do always take them from a real context. So every single article I've ever written has always been based on a real life situation or a real life, you know, technique that I've used in a real app. So it's not just something that I come up with for an article, it's actually something I have used. So taking my techniques and putting them into this app and actually, you know, with the goal of open sourcing it and having something to show everybody was not that hard because the techniques were already, you know, usable in the real life anyway. So yeah, it's been exciting to work on this.
Yeah, it would be really hard for you to like come up with the crazy little techniques just for articles that you never used in real life. How would you sell them?
Exactly. I mean, there's a difference because sometimes I do these small little Swift tips, and sometimes with those, I can just say, well, here's a cool way to, I don't know, combine these functions in this way or to use this language feature. And it might not be something that is like super practically usable, you know, every single day. But with my articles, I definitely always want that. I want it to be always something that you can just take and actually use. And, you know, you might not use all of my techniques from all of my, I think it's 93 articles now at this point in every single app. That's not the point, but it might give you like an additional technique that you can use if you were to face a problem that it's a good fit for, you know, in the future.
Yeah, a good example of that was like, I think last week, someone shared an article by Ops.io, I think it was, mentioning that you can have computed variables inside functions in Swift. And that's like one of those things that is cool, and but it's not something that you're going to use every day. It's more like a very rare thing for you to want to do that.
Yeah.
And it could even become like a cold smell if you do it too much.
Right.
I mentioned then that you could also do did set for variables inside a function, which is fun as well. And many people didn't know about it, but it's also something that I don't use all the time. Like I've used it once, I think, in real life.
Yeah, and I mean, I think those things are super fun too. And I think it's also good for us as Swift developers to, or whatever language that you're using, to, you know, learn more about the language itself. Because the fact that you can do a did set on a computed variable or a property that you declare inside the scope of a function might not seem useful, but it's interesting from kind of a language design perspective. And to also understand more about how the language works under the hood and how the type system works, which can help you in the future also for just solving real concrete problems when you learn more about these things. So I think staying curious is a good thing, and, you know, not dismissing something, you know, at face value and saying, you know, oh, that will never be usable, because you never know. So yeah, I think it's a good idea to keep learning and keep exploring the language for sure.
So speaking of writing code and using techniques in real life, you've been doing some iPad work, and I think we mentioned that in the last episode with Renee, but I think we should dive into them a little bit more.
Let's do it. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So during the last couple of weeks, I've been publishing a couple of different prototypes on Twitter, and I've just been having fun with my new iPad Pro because, you know, like we mentioned on the last episode, the first thing I really did when I got this device was just to unbox it and plug it into Xcode and to actually start building things with it. You know, most people, they would, you know, have some fun with a device, you know, maybe play some games or use some apps. I would just, no, let me just build something for this, because it is a very inspiring device to me. And especially since I haven't had an iPad for quite a while, I've been kind of building up a lot of different ideas and things that I have been wanting to see on a device like this. And yeah, I just thought it would be fun to do some prototypes to actually see how they would work in real life.
Yeah, and we want to talk about what would it take for iPads, both in terms of OS and hardware, which I think we both agree that in terms of hardware, it's already very advanced and much already there. But what would it take for the OS and the third-party apps to really take advantage of this hardware? And I think your prototypes are an example of that.
Yeah, so what I've tried to do with the prototypes is two things, really. Like, the first thing is to really try to take advantage of the Apple Pencil. Because if we think about it, the Apple Pencil doesn't only provide a way to, like, draw and to do artistic things with the iPad in a more kind of precise manner. It is also a pointing device. Because in code, we can actually differentiate between a normal touch and a pencil input. So when the user touches the screen and when the pencil touches the screen, that is actually kind of the same event per default. So that would be called, you know, touches began, for example. You would have a touch recognizer or a gesture recognizer in code that would detect this interaction. But then you can actually check in the code, you can check, was this actually a direct input, like with the user's finger, or was it, did it come from a pencil? And I think this is interesting because so far in the kind of lifespan of iOS, we've been primarily interacting with the devices, you know, with touch. That's kind of what they, you know, were built for. So, you know, we have taps, we have gestures, we have, of course, things like rotation, and we have sensors like accelerometer and things like that. But the pencil is the first time where we can actually say, here are two direct means of interaction, but we can differentiate it between them. And for me, when I look at that, I feel like that's kind of the same as having a direct, like a default click on the mouse on the Mac and a alternative click, like a right click. And it gives you just this whole new layer of interaction. And that's kind of what I've been exploring with. What if you could take the Apple Pencil and you can just drag it over the screen to do like boxed selection? So you could have a collection view, like, for example, a grid of photos, and you can just slide over that with a pencil to select multiple photos. Or you could use the pencil as a tool for editing something. Like, let's say you're building a game and you can play your game, you can, you know, run it in debug mode, but then as soon as you touch the pencil onto the screen, you can use the pencil to edit the game, like live edit it while you're playing, which is, you know, incredible in terms of productivity. And I just think these are some of examples of just like how we could differentiate between the pencil and touch, and how we could use touch for normal input and then have very specific tasks that we use the pencil for.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the pencil is a different type of touch. And do you think we could get like a different type of quote-unquote touch for like a trackpad?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in many ways, you know, let's say that iOS would support trackpads and mice in the future. You know, maybe Apple would ship a trackpad on the keyboard folio, for example. I think that you could also say that you could either use the pencil as selection or the mouse, and it would actually be the same thing. Because, for example, if you have a text field, if you take the pencil and you drag over text, you could easily select that text. In fact, that's what was one of my prototypes, like, you know, dragging over just like you would with the mouse, because it is a very precise tool. And I think if you would add support as well for trackpads and mice and things like that, you could kind of maybe treat them the same way in many ways in the operating system.
Yeah, and you did a demo of text selection using the Apple Pencil, and I thought about the demo you did, and I was thinking maybe if Apple did something like that, they would do like you actually draw a line over phrases to select it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, you could do that. You could visualize the selection with like a line or something like that. Like what I was going for was just to make it as close as possible to the text selection experience on the Mac, right? Because that's one area where I feel like iOS is still kind of far behind in terms of working with text, where, you know, if I'm on the Mac and I want to select a paragraph, I just click on the mouse and drag, and it, you know, takes just less than a second. But on iOS, you have to like touch and hold and drag, you know, you have to do this whole manipulation with lots of different steps. And I wanted to see like, okay, what if I just touch the pencil onto the screen and drag just like I would with the mouse, and, you know, it can become the same kind of level of speed, and you can have the same efficiency with it. So that was one of the prototypes, and yeah, I really do hope that Apple will Sherlock this and actually, you know, implement it system wide, because it's one of those things where, you know, I could build an app that uses this and that has that as like a feature, but unless users are used to it and users know that there's something they can do, you know, chances are not that high that I will kind of revolutionize the whole iPad industry or whatever. But if Apple would indeed like use the pencil for more things than just drawing, I think that could be really, really cool.
Yeah, and it's interesting that when we talk about what the iPad needs in terms of software, we need to be careful not to be wishing for a Mac.
Yeah.
Which is a complaint I see many people who are into iPad already say that, oh, these Mac people just want the iPad to become a Mac. Let's try and come up with some examples of things we would like to see that don't relate to making it more like a Mac. And I have like a canonical example of something that always bothers me when I'm trying to use an iPad to do like more serious work.
Yeah.
And it's zip files.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like to deal with zip files on iOS is a nightmare.
Yeah, I've never even tried. Like, how would you do that? You would open them in the Files app and then you would have an app that unzips them? Or how would that work?
I think you need like a separate app that can handle zip files. And mm-hmm. That there are some like probably some shortcuts you can come up with. But it is tricky. Like there is an action in shortcuts, I think, for compressing files.
Okay.
And it's funny because, short aside, any app on iOS has read access to the system folders, like /system/library/private frameworks. You can read any file from there because apps need to read those folders to be able to work, because your app links to public frameworks and the public frameworks link against private frameworks.
All right.
So your app's process needs to be able to read system directories, and some of them it can't, and some of them it can't.
Mm-hmm.
But one little example that I think the first person who shared it was Steve Troughton Smith was of zipping up Springboard, the Springboard's app folder, and like uploading it somewhere.
Actually doing that on an iOS device.
On an iPad, yeah.
That's fantastic. That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's an aside, but I thought it was very funny. And yeah. You can do it with several different folders. I tried many of them. One of them, which would be really useful, would be the wallpapers folder.
Oh, yeah.
Like the built-in ones, but mm-hmm. You can't. That one you can't read, unfortunately.
Okay, all right.
So, yeah, I thought that was funny. So, zip files is like one example I always give of something that I think is more difficult than it should be to deal with on iOS. And when I say iOS, I mean mainly the iPad, because that's where I usually want to actually do some real work. But if those changes could come to iPhone as well, I wouldn't complain.
Yeah.
I don't know how they could like fix this, but maybe just add built-in support to the Files app. That could be enough, I think.
Yeah, so I think kind of the blessing and the curse of the iPad is the whole kind of app-centric model, where everything you do happens within the context of an app. And all the documents you save, they are saved within the app container. And then you have the Files app now, which can kind of act as a little bit like a bridge between apps. So you have apps like, you know, Working Copy, which is a popular Git client. And you have certain text editors and things like that that can, you know, use the Files app and use those resources and load them into the app and actually, so you can actually use them, right? But that's kind of one example of what I would like to call like glue, right? Where you're taking two apps and kind of gluing them together a little bit, or acting as a bridge. Maybe bridge is a better term than glue in this case. And I think we just need more of those bridges. Like, I think that in order to make the iPad more powerful, but not turn it into a Mac, to your point, you know, the Mac way of doing a zip file support would be, well, let's just, you know, enable apps to add some kind of system extension or just modify the system so you can right click on any zip file and, you know, say unzip and it will just find the right application and just do it. And it will all happen in the background and then you will have your unzipped folder and you're good to go. And yeah, that's the model we're used to on the Mac, which, you know, it's easy to think that's the most optimal solution. But I think that you could definitely find ways to do the same thing, but with this app-centric model. So Shortcuts, I think, is a great example of that, where now, for the first time, apps are doing work in the background, and the user is not always prompted. The user doesn't always have to be the one to like go into one app, copy that, open the Files app, paste, go open this other app, slide it over in the slide over mode. You know, it's too much work, right? You know, what would be awesome in this case would be, for example, to say, you know, in the Files app, to be able to say, let me run this command or run this action. And then you as the user could define, okay, when I wanna click this folder or this zip file here, and I wanna invoke this action from this app. So an app could expose actions, for example.
Yeah, just to be clear, you can already do that, I think, because I just checked and Shortcuts has an extract archive action. So you can make a shortcut that's just that, and it accepts files as an input. And you can go into the Files app and go into the share sheet and just select your shortcut. But you see, this is the problem I have with iPad.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to come up with these crazy workarounds for the simple action of extracting a zip file. Like, yeah. Even having to open up the share sheet is too much.
I agree. And that's where I think there's a big difference between what I'm kind of proposing and I would think what I think you're proposing as well is, you know, let us just be able to tap on the file or the zip file. And there would be a context menu and it would be something like, you know, run action. And you would just say unzip, boom. And then that would be it. And these actions would come from apps kind of exposing that directly instead of having to go through Shortcuts and have that invoke something and have that invoke, you know, instead of having to do these like crazy machines in order to do a simple task to put all of that stuff more front and center.
Yeah, this is interesting because many people say that iOS and iPad are not ready for the pro users or the advanced users. But this that we are mentioning right now is definitely not a pro user feature. I'm actually complaining about something that pro users can do very easily. Like if you're a pro user, if you're an advanced user, you can just create a shortcut and be done with it. But if you're like a regular user or you just want it to be there for you already, then you're out of luck. You have to learn shortcuts and learn how to deal with share sheets and stuff. So yeah, I think it's more ready for pro users than for non-pro users.
So I have a couple of other examples where I think this kind of action model could be quite nice. So for example, let's say that I have a piece of text somewhere in a document and I just want to select that piece of text and send it to you, for example. So right now what I would have to do is, you know, without this nice pencil support for selecting text, I would have to, you know, long tap, drag over the text, wait for a second, try to do this like perfect timing in order to get the context menu to pop up, select copy, jump over to messages, paste, find the conversation with you, paste that and send that, right? Where, imagine again this action model where let's say that you would be able to take the pencil, you would drag over the text to select it, a little pop-up would pop up and you could say run action, and then you would get your action. So you could say send to Rambo, for example, and then boom, off it goes. So I think, you know, this kind of action metaphor, which I just see as a kind of like a system-wide extension of the whole thing they've been building with shortcuts, to kind of take that shortcuts thing and not only have it, you know, be in the shortcuts app, but actually promote it to be kind of a system-level feature.
Yeah, and they could use the contextual app system to improve that. Like you mentioned, send to Rambo. If you've just been talking to me on an app, that could be like the first action that appears.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it knows you've just been talking to me, so there's a high chance that you want to send that to me. And it could be even more clever and like run an algorithm or a machine learning thing through the item that you want to share to figure out which person you'd probably want to be sharing that with. Like if it's an article about some cool Swift thing, it would be for me. And if it's like a good food for Friday, it would be for your girlfriend or something.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, I think we're hitting the point now where this is where iOS has the potential to not only become as good as the Mac, but actually better than the Mac, where iOS has much more intimate knowledge about what you do in which apps and which tasks you perform. Because not only are you always in the context of an app, you are always operating within an app, you also have like NS user activity, and you have all of these different APIs that Apple have been building up where the OS now knows so much more about what we do. And it's good that this Apple that we're talking about, because they're, you know, they keep it on the device and they don't use it for creepy reasons. Hopefully, with what they tell us about anyway. So I think this is a great opportunity because just like you say, these actions or these suggested actions that you would get, they could be super clever. And this is another area where we talked actually with Renee as well last episode where, you know, this little shelf of suggested apps that Siri suggests to you are not always super useful because they only appear in this very specific place. But what if you would get those kind of predictions everywhere? You know, it would make it the operating system feel a lot more smart, and it would make it feel more fluid to use because your next kind of action would always be a little bit anticipated.
Yeah, and by the way, I learned recently that iOS actually learns about your interests as well. So if you read a lot of articles about Swift, it knows that you are interested in Swift. And that's all local as well. But iOS has that knowledge. And I think it's not being explored to its full potential.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. there's a ton of things to do here. And I think this is a little bit like, you know, like we mentioned when we talked about screen time, Apple has been collecting this data for a while, right? But it's only now that they're actually surfacing it. And I think this is a good approach to like start building it up because it takes a long time to actually build up enough data to actually, you know, make really good predictions. So it's good that the data is being collected and stored locally. But let's see what they can do to actually use it. And again, I really hope that Apple doesn't take all of these responsibility on their own shoulders and says, you know, we need to be the ones coming up with this stuff. I really hope that they just expose this like action API, and then apps can implement these kind of things, because there are so many cool things that could happen. You know, let's say in the camera app, you take a photo, you know, why not be able to just like click one button and post it to Instagram if that's what you want to do?
Yeah, you already have the share sheets for that, but that could be a better way to integrate them. And speaking of, you mentioned Apple first gets the data and then they actually use it, like with screen time. It's interesting because they are in a different position than most competitors in that they do this data collection, but it's all local to your device. So the way for them to actually test out these types of predictions is that they have to either do something, some prediction on your device and send like some results to their servers, to analytics and stuff, which can't identify you and et cetera, and also like do internal testing with their own people. And they have lots of employees, so they can probably do some internal testing of new features like these and have some good results.
Yeah.
But they are in a different position than like Google. Google sends everything to their servers, so I guess it's easier for them to just gather a bunch of data and test with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, having access to all this data, it makes it a lot easier to do these kind of things. And in many ways, the way Apple has taken this kind of strong stance on privacy and have all the data only be local on the device, you know, is making things more difficult for them. And, you know, in one way, it's really honorable that they do this, because I do believe also that it's the right approach. And, you know, that's also what makes me feel a lot, you know, feel better about using Apple products, because I feel that the data is more safe. But it is presenting some interesting challenges, and it might be a reason why Apple sometimes feels like they're moving slower in this field. But I also think that given enough time, they could like really leapfrog, because they do have this like closed system and they are in very tight control and they have this intimate knowledge about all these things. So I think there's a big potential here for really implementing these really, really intelligent features quite quickly.
Yeah, it feels like they're slower in this area, both because of this and also because they don't announce, usually don't pre-announce things. Definitely not software features, like major software features like, oh, iOS is now going to predict when the next eclipse is going to happen or something.
Right.
those types of features, they don't pre-announce. They do pre-announce some devices, as you know.
Yeah, exactly. Some devices, especially when they're related to charging, right?
Exactly.
So another thing I've been thinking about is how iPad apps are in this sometimes a little bit strange limbo state, where it feels that most, not all, but most iPad apps are either enlarged versions of an iPhone app. So they will take an iPhone app and just have the exact same feature set, but just kind of adapt the UI and sometimes not adapt the UI, unfortunately, but really like offer the same functionality as on the iPhone, but just in a bigger device. Or the other category is coming from the Mac, where there's some apps that takes the functionality of a Mac app, but then kind of iPadsify it, if you will. And what I've been thinking a lot about is like, you know, the iPad has always been positioned as this device that kind of is this middle category. It's not a laptop and it's not a phone. You know, it's somewhere in the middle. And I feel like the software, you know, not only from iOS perspective, like, you know, in terms of the system, but also kind of for third-party apps, there's very little software that can be described like that. Like most software can either be described as bigger versions of a phone app or smaller versions of a Mac app. So that's also another thing that I wanted to explore with these prototypes, and some of the new prototypes I have in the works are a lot about that. Like, what are some of the unique aspects of iPad and how can we kind of take advantage of them in an app without worrying too much about how it behaves on a phone or on a Mac?
I think I can cite two apps or like sets of apps that define this difference very well, in my opinion. Like the Affinity group of apps, like all apps by Affinity, they feel like iPad apps. They are iPad apps. They have been designed with the iPad in mind, and they work very well, and they are fully functional. They have many, many features, many more features than I would ever need, but they are real iPad apps.
Yeah.
And then there's Pixelmator for mm-hmm. iPad, and I use it sometimes, and I feel completely lost. Like, where is everything? Like, how do I can't find anything in that app. Either because it's not there, the feature is not implemented, or because the UI is so confusing and things are hidden. But in the other hand, I use Pixelmator on my iPhone sometimes to do some simple image manipulation. And on my iPhone, it feels great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really the challenge here, you know, because on a touchscreen, you also don't want to obscure the whole canvas with controls, right? You want to leave that up, especially in an app that is about creation. You want to leave that available for creation, right? So in an app like Pixelmator, one thing I've seen them do quite a lot is, you know, they try to hide as many of the things as possible so you are free to do drawing. And of course, this has pros and cons. Like, you know, for example, for the longest time when I was using the app, and I was using it on a plane that didn't have Wi-Fi, so I was left to my own devices to figure it out, which was kind of fun. I figured out, oh, you have to slide from the side in order to reveal the layers, for example. And again, pros and cons. Like, once you learn that gesture, you know, it's actually really convenient because the layers are kind of getting out of the way. But yeah, it is definitely a big challenge. And, you know, one thing I've been thinking quite a lot about is, you know, how we would approach different tasks if we didn't have the Mac. So for example, text input, let's take that as an example. And I mentioned on the last episode that I've been doing more and more dictation lately. You know, how would a writing app look like, you know, if it wasn't designed first with a keyboard? And if you look at all the writing apps that I've tried, at least out there, you know, they are designed just like a Mac writing app. Like, they have a text view and you can connect your keyboard, of course, and you can type, or you can type on the on-screen keyboard, but you're typing text, you know, using a keyboard onto the screen. And I think if we keep just following this model, it's going to be hard for the iPad to, you know, really excel, because it's never going to be as good as the Mac, because the Mac is great with a keyboard and a mouse. And it's never going to be, you know, it's kind of, you know, own big great thing. And this is for me, like, really kind of hits the nail here. Like, this is the problem where, you know, can we come up with another alternative way of inputting text? Perhaps it's, you know, voice. Perhaps it's tokenizing the text in a way where it's easier to manipulate with touch and things like that. But trying to think outside of the box of saying, you know, let's not just take a Mac app, take this text field that we're used to on a Mac app and put it on an iPad, because I don't really see the point with that. Like, it would be more interesting to see what can we do to use the characteristics of this device and make something that is really kind of touch first instead of, you know, just trying to adapt patterns that we're already used to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think we should be thinking about this new device as a new device and not as a different version of something old. And I hope Apple does something about it next year with iOS 13, preferably if it involves changing Spring BART, which, you know, I'm really excited about.
Yeah, that's a great example, by the way. Talk about taking the iPhone and just blowing it up, right? It's literally that. Like, that would be great to see, like, a reinvention of or a complete change in Spring BART to make that iPad specific instead of just saying, let's just do the exact same UI as on the iPhone.
Yeah, I don't think it needs to change on iPhone, to be honest.
No.
Maybe they could add, like, I don't know, widgets or something that people have been asking for many years. Maybe dynamic icons for apps.
Yeah.
But on iPads, I don't think a grid of icons works. I think it should be something else. And you could have, like, launchpad on, like, you could, Spring BART could be an icon in the dock, and you just open Spring BART, and that's where you see all the apps. Which, by the way, we have Launchpad on the Mac, and I never use it.
No, me neither. Never, ever.
Yeah. And even on iPad, I usually use Spotlight to launch apps.
Yeah. It would be interesting to hear. I mean, we would probably never get this data out of Apple, but it would be interesting to see how many people actually use Spotlight this way. Because I do too, but I feel like it's a power user kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I've seen, like, people who are not very tech savvy using the Mac. And I've seen some people in that category using Spotlight to launch apps, which they don't have in the dock. Like,
right.
They usually have... I have many apps in the dock as well, but I've seen non-tech people using Spotlight on the Mac. So I'm not sure how popular it is on iOS, though.
All right. Next up, we want to answer some of your questions that you've sent in using our hashtag AskStackTrace. Because we've gotten quite a lot of questions from you, which is really, really awesome. And if you want to send in your own questions, then you can just do so by tweeting out into the whole Twitter with the hashtag AskStackTrace. And we'll find it, pick it up, and hopefully answer it on a future episode. But before we get into our Q&A part, we actually want to take a very quick break and thank some of our really good friends on Patreon. So as you might know, we are running a Patreon for the show, and our goal is to make the show fully funded by Patreons, so that we can keep doing the show, even do it every week if possible. And everyone who's helping us on Patreon is really playing a really big part in making that happen. And especially we want to thank our good friends of the show, which are the people who are helping us with $30 or more per month, which we are really, really grateful for. And that is right now Chris Campbell, that is Harsh Dubai, that is Igor Ferreira, that is Kristaps Grinsbergs, and that is Viger. Thank you so much, and sorry if I mispronounced some of those names, but thank you so much to all of you, and of course to everyone else who is helping us on Patreon. It really means a lot to us, and we hope that you consider maybe chipping in a few bucks every month if you are not already doing so, because it really helps a lot. But with that being said, let's move over and talk about Ask StackTrace and answer some questions from the audience. So, Rambo, what is our first question?
Our first question comes from Dylan, and he asked, do you think someday Rambo will be found in iOS source file code, like a comment, hi, Rambo, or not to be seen by Rambo?
I love this question. So great.
Well, I've never seen anything like that. Maybe someday.
But you also don't see comments, right? Can you see comments when you're spelunking?
No, of course not. But sometimes there are some symbols that have some funny names. Like,
yeah,
there's one famous one, which is "Do not use or you will be fired," which is the name of a method.
Yeah,
There is even some content, like placeholder content, that can be found inside iOS releases, like for podcasts, for instance. So there's like a link to the Hypercritical podcast.
Really?
Inside iOS. Yeah, because they have data for some test or something, and for some reason it ends up in the public release. So there is some fun stuff that can be found.
Yeah, so there could be there like a link to your Twitter or something like that, or to rambo.codes in the future, who knows?
Yeah, it's not impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be really, really funny. That would be like a fun meta joke, you know? Like, they know that you're going to take this apart and, you know, to put something like in there. Because one technique that a lot of companies, including Apple, uses is that they will take some of the symbols in the code and actually rename them as kind of a compiler step. So you'll have a method, let's say it's called like unlock premium version. And then as you're compiling the app, you will change the name of that into something else. So it will be harder to figure out exactly what it's for. But when you are working with it, you can just call that method using that real name, but it will use a macro or something to kind of rename it in the compilation process.
Yeah, they also use lots of if-defs for unreleased hardware and stuff, which is funny.
Exactly. If def Rambo, else. Yeah, so we'll keep an eye out, Dylan, or Rambo will keep an eye out for his own name in the source code, and maybe we'll find something one day that would be really cool. Our next question comes from Robert, and Robert wants us to talk a little bit about what our favorite solutions are for backing up our Macs. So this is a question that I think a lot of people have on their mind, and you know, what should I use for backup, local backup versus cloud backup, et cetera, et cetera. So Rambo, how do you make sure your data is backed up and secure?
Well, first of all, I want to plug an episode of the iFreaks show, which I did with our friend Erica Sadun, and we talked all about backups. I think we spent like an hour talking just about backups.
Oh, wow.
If you believe it. But basically, everything that's very important to me is in the cloud, which that's not a backup, but it's like it's safer than just having a copy on your hard drive. So I use Dropbox for documents and sharing and stuff. And of course, all the code is either on GitHub or Bitbucket. I used to use Bitbucket for private repos before I was a paid subscriber to GitHub. And now I'm slowly migrating all of my private stuff to GitHub as well. Yeah, so I use that, and I use for like photos, I use iCloud, and I use iCloud Drive for some things, not much, but some things. So all of my really, really important stuff is already in the cloud. So if my hard drive or my SSD explodes or something, I don't lose anything, really. But I also do Time Machine backups. And I do them at least once a week because I use a laptop and it's not always plugged in. So I try to at least on the weekend leave it at night plugged in with the external hard drive installed so I can do the Time Machine backup. And that's my current backup strategy.
Cool. Yeah, I think that there's many different ways you can go about it, and you can use like local backups like Time Machine or just like some other software. You can use cloud services. You can put things in the cloud like, you know, on services like GitHub and, you know, iCloud Photos and things like that. But I think regardless of what you choose, like the actual methods of backing up is not the most important part. The most important part is to make sure you have redundancy, right? Like that's what backups are all about to begin with. But you need also redundancy for your redundancy. So my personal policy is that everything that's really important to me, whether that's like my photos, my source code, you know, my blog posts, my articles, everything that is really important to me that would be really a big disaster if it was to be gone, I want to have in at least three places. Four would be optimal, but at least three places. So that can include, for example, I use Backblaze, which is my preferred cloud backup provider. So Backblaze is always running on my Mac. It's always backing up to their service. I use Time Machine for local backups as well. And then, for example, for my code and for my articles, I have them on GitHub. I also have them on iCloud Drive. So, you know, it's all about this redundancy. And I think right now in this this time that we live in, it's possible to do that quite easily. So for example, if you want to make sure, if you have some repository of stuff, whether that's like articles or code or whatever, you know, you could clone that into your iCloud Drive and actually have that be, you know, be on iCloud Drive and also be on GitHub, and it's a Git repository, and you can just commit and push to that. And if you also put Backblaze on top of that or some other cloud provider, and you also do Time Machine backups, well, then you have four different sources of backups plus your local copy. So, you know, that's pretty good. And that's my general strategy for backups, is to just make sure it's in as many places as possible, but I want to make sure that all those places are fully under my control, that they're encrypted, and that it's not, you know, something that I don't know where it is. So, yeah, that's my general strategy.
Yeah, I've had people before tell me like, oh, you could use this really cheap service that has servers in insert random place in the world here. Like, no, thank you. Like, there are even some free ones. I don't really like that idea.
And, no, yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I decided to move my private repos to GitHub. It's not that I don't trust Bitbucket and Atlassian, the guys behind it. Like, I'm pretty sure that it's really good service, and I don't have any evidence that they have done anything wrong, but it's free, and so it's weird.
Yeah, whenever something is free, you know, in this day and age, you always have to ask yourself, what's the monetization model, right? Like, how is this company benefiting from having my source code or having my photos or having my information or whatever it might be? And, you know, it's a little bit tinfoil hatty to always think that way, to be like, you know, always look around the corner and think, oh, how are they misusing my data? But, you know, at some point they will need to monetize, and I would rather, with something like a backup, I would rather pay like Backblaze $5 a month or whatever it is, you know, it's in the grand scheme of things, it's a very small price to pay for knowing that my data is always safe and backed up and encrypted and it's continuously uploading in the background. So if I forget to commit something to my repo and I would drop my computer in the river, that my my source code is safe.
Yeah, and like a Bitbucket, they have a revenue model, but it's better that I host my private stuff with GitHub that I'm paying for. So I'm definitely going to get at least better support because I'm paying for it. So usually when you're a paid customer, support is a little bit more prioritized.
You can always play the paying customer card, right?
Yeah,
I'm a paying customer. Yeah, exactly. Or in the case of open source, when people are playing the, I'm not paying for this card. All right, moving on. That was a great question, Robert. I think this is, again, is something where, there's no given right or wrong solution. It's all about, trying to draw out, if you have an iPad, use your Apple Pencil and draw out where your backups are and where your data is, and to make sure that everything is, in at least a couple of different places. I think it's the key to happiness here. The next question comes from Bas, and Bas wants to hear what our monitor setup is for development. That do we use one or multiple monitors? Do we use 4K or 5K? What kind of size of monitors do we have? So Rambo, if I don't misremember, I think that you actually just work from a laptop, don't you?
Yes, I have the 2018 15-inch MacBook Pro. And I'm currently using it with a built-in Retina display, and I opened up the system preferences here to check it out, and I am using the default for display resolution. So that's like the middle range one, which it's not too big and not too small.
Yeah, it's a good size for when that's your primary display. As people might remember, if you've been listening to the show for a while, I have my non-pro laptop. So I've got my 13-inch because I love small computers, but I do love big screens, which might seem to be in conflict. But this is where the external monitors come in. So I use a Samsung 4K display. It's not a fancy display in any way. But it's a pretty good one. Like, I really like Samsung's displays. I think they hit the nice balance between price and quality. I didn't pay too much for this display, not at all. And it's been a great display. I've had it for a couple of years. And it's a 4K display, good image quality, and works great with my 13-inch MacBook Pro. So yeah, my MacBook Pro is right now sitting next to me in a clamshell in a nice little case, or what do you want to call it, a stand. And it's connected to my 4K display.
Nice. Yeah, I used that before, I think many years ago when I was just getting started with iOS development. I had, I think, a 13-inch MacBook Pro at the time, and I used it connected to an external display. I'm not sure exactly the specific reason that maybe made me not want to do that anymore, but I just like having the same setup all the time and not changing context all the time. So having just this one notebook that's always with me and that I can just open up and start working, whether it's in the office or my home or the beach or the airplane or whatever,
right,
is really, I think it helps me be more productive by just always being on the same environment. But there's the catch that now I have a secondary MacBook Pro, which is the non-pro, the same that you have.
Yeah.
Also known as a MacBook Escape.
Exactly.
So I've been traveling with that one, and it's really good for travel. So I'm flying to Switzerland tomorrow as we are recording. And so I'm going to bring my 13-inch one with me.
Yeah, that's awesome. My end goal right now with my setup is that I will have a powerful Mac at home. So I am thinking about either buying the Mac Mini that exists now, like the one that just came out, or waiting for the Mac Pro. But, I don't know, because I know the Mac Pro is going to be crazy expensive. And I know that I'm going to see the price tag. I'm going to think, no way I'm spending that money on a computer. So I'll probably just end up getting the Mac Mini. I haven't decided yet. But anyway, my idea is that I will have a desktop computer at home that will be connected to my monitor. And that's what I will use for all my development, all that stuff. But then when I'm traveling, I just want to bring the iPad. Like, this is my end goal. And of course, right now, that's not really possible. But, you know, it's getting there. And I hope also with some of the apps that I plan to build for myself and for others to try to make the iPad into more of a capable developer machine on the go. So yeah, we'll see what's going to happen in the future. That's kind of my dream because I do love the fact that I do love like the idea of having something really thin and light for travel. And you know, this iPad is like, it's even smaller and lighter than my 13 inch. So yeah, that's always going to win.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Please help us, John.
I will do my best. I need some help, though. I can't do it all by myself. But there's a lot of great developers working on this problem also. So I know I'm not alone. And yeah, I just hope to be able to play my part and to do what I can. But yeah, we'll see what's going to happen.
And this is not poker, but I'll say the Mac Pro will start at like $5,000 or something.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's and I know myself, like, I'm not going to spend that money on that stuff because, yeah, for me, it's just crazy to do that. But yeah, because I don't really need it. So I think the Mac Mini is probably going to be the machine for me. Yeah.
What about the iMac Pro?
It's too expensive.
The iMac Pro is too expensive and you're thinking about buying the Mac Pro?
Well, the thing is that the current Mac Pro starts at $3,000 and the iMac Pro starts at $5,000. So $3,000 for me is still too expensive. But if I spend a couple of months convincing myself that I need this, I could probably maybe do it. But it would be hard. It would be really hard. But I know that the next Mac Pro is not going to start at $3,000, right? Like, Apple, since when does Apple release a new product with the same price, right? So, yeah, I know it's going to be expensive. And I mean, it's not that I'm saying that you don't, it's not worth it, because for some people it is. Like, the hardware is incredible. Like, the iMac Pro, the hardware is incredible. Like, the screen, the internals, everything is incredible. But, you know, I don't need it. Like, I write code, I write articles, that's what I do. And I don't need like a Xeon processor with 15 cores. You know, this is, it's not needed for me. So yeah, I think I might just go for the Mac Mini.
Well, now that you mentioned the iMac Pro, I'm thinking maybe the Mac Pro will be less expensive because you don't have the screen. Yeah. And you also don't, it doesn't come with a keyboard and a mouse, right?
Kind of insignificant in the grand scheme of things, right?
If you're spending, are expensive.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, all Apple stuff is pricey, right? So,
By the way, how's the price in Poland?
It's funny because they are higher than in Sweden, which, you know, it's the only thing that is more expensive in Poland than in Sweden, because Sweden is one of the most expensive countries in the world. So yeah, but they are quite high. I don't know why. I guess it's some import tax kind of thing, like for many different countries.
You mentioned Sweden being one of the most expensive countries in the world, and I think amateurs.
Yeah, well, now I'm not talking about Apple hardware in particular. I'm talking about everything else, like, you know, going out to eat and stuff like that is
booze.
Yeah, exactly. The things that matter, Rambo, the things that matter. All right, let's move on to the next question and talk about a little bit about Swift versus Objective-C, because that's what Gabriel wants us to do.
Ooh.
So this is a fun one, right? What exactly Gabriel means with Swift versus Objective-C is a good question. I'm guessing that it's just like what our opinions are of where Swift is better than Objective-C or the other way around. So Rambo, why don't you start? Like, how do you feel about Objective-C these days?
I love Objective-C.
Because it enables you to do spelunking.
Yeah, and it enables me to message new things. I've mentioned this before. I really like Objective-C. I've always liked it. When I started working on Mac and iOS with Objective-C, even before we had ARC, or Automatic Reference Counting, which is a very good feature. But yeah, I really love Objective-C. But these days, I think I love Swift even more. Like, I love enums, and I love associated types and generics, and even optionals I like.
Yeah.
So when I do write Objective-C these days, I'm really like nervous about, oh, I need to check if this is new, and oh, and what type is this? The compiler won't tell me. I have to.
Swift has ruined you.
Yeah, and then I have to like do this kind of class and stuff to, because I'm used to the type safety of Swift. And but what I miss the most really when I'm working in Objective-C are enums. Oh my god, enums! Enums are so useful, and I use them everywhere. Protocols are also cool, and first class functions as well. I can't write a block in Objective-C without opening up freakingblocksyntax.com.
Which is not the actual URL, but yeah, we have to say it that way.
I think it does have that one as well.
Because, oh, it does. Okay, that's great. That's smart.
It was blocked in some VPNs, company VPNs, because it contains a very bad F word. So they registered an alternate domain.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so I really like both, but these days, when I start a new project, I go for Swift because it's what's new and what I enjoy the most. And the main difference, which I believe I noticed, like right as I started getting productive with Swift, because when you start working with a new language, there's a period of time where you're not very productive, because you're still learning the syntax and stuff. And right after I started getting productive with Swift, I noticed that you get way, way less runtime errors, which is very common with Objective-C. Like you would message an object of a different type and you would get like unrecognized selector, or you would try to dereference a null pointer in a way, which is not really Objective-C. It's more of a C thing, but it could happen. Or you would have something that's new, that shouldn't be new, and nothing would happen, and you wouldn't know why. And in Swift, you get a nice crash, depending on how you implement it. And crashes are good when they actually tell you about a programmer error.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's better to crash than to end up in an undefined state where you could, you know, accidentally delete database records or do some other harm to user data or to your own servers or something like that.
Yeah, or you're just sitting there watching and nothing happens and you don't know why. And if it crashes, at least you know.
Exactly. Something happened. Absolutely. Yeah, you're just sitting in there and your device gets warmer and warmer and warmer. And you're like, maybe it's an infinite loop here. Something is just going over and over again and never stopping. I mean, I definitely agree. I think that Objective-C is an amazing language, honestly. Like, you know, I don't think you need to hate Objective-C in order to appreciate Swift. The same way, I don't think you need to hate like JavaScript or Python or more dynamic languages, even if you do like the strong type safety aspects of Swift. And, you know, like yourself, I've definitely become accustomed to those things. And writing Objective-C now or JavaScript, which I do sometimes for my site, it feels kind of archaic, right? Where you're like, well, where are my types? Where's my safety? Where's my compiler? You know, where's all this help that I'm getting? And, you know, this is not something that only Swift does. Like, this is something that's been a trend in programming for quite a while and with other languages as well, where, you know, strong type safety and compile time checks has really become, you know, very, very popular amongst the wide range of languages. And it's a good reason for it. Like you say, there are less runtime errors if you're checking things at compile time. And if you can leverage the type system with things like enums and generics and things like that and first class functions, you can just be more productive and you can write code that, you know, connects itself in a way that guarantees that the two parts that are connecting actually are compatible. Where I can write code now that says, you know, all the way from my network down to my view where I am, you know, rendering some data, the whole way I am sure that these types work and that everything is connected and that all the errors are handled along the way. And this is something that, of course, you could do in languages like Objective-C, but it required you to always think about it and to always have that in mind and to always write that extra code. And sometimes, honestly, in Objective-C, when you would write code that way because you didn't have those language features, it would be too much like defensive programming, where if you, in every single code block, you're always checking is kind of class, is not nil, etc., you're kind of polluting your code with all these, you know, if statements that you're never really expecting to be triggered anyway. You're just putting them in there for kind of safety.
By the way, is kind of class is a very slow call.
Yeah, because it has to go through the whole lookup table and, you know, traverse it and things like that. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of defensive programming in that way. But I do love the fact that in Swift, we don't really have to be defensive. Like, the language is defensive for us, which I think is much better.
Yeah, like one of my favorite things of when working with Swift is when I have to like do a refactor and I change some types here and there. And I need to know where I need to change now because I have done a refactor at a lower level. So I just hit Command B to build and the compiler will tell me there are five errors. There are five places I need to check. So
absolutely.
In Obj-C, it could happen that you change the type of something in a refactor and you have to go looking for the old thing because the compiler won't tell you.
Yeah, and it gets even worse in languages like PHP, for example, right? Where you're just like, everything is very dynamically evaluated. So I remember I was writing PHP and I was doing refactors and I had to like literally, because this was way before I did any kind of unit testing or anything like that. So I had to literally like, you know, call all the endpoints of the API I was building and making sure, okay, they all still work, which, you know, in retrospect, it feels like, you know, it feels like the caveman days. So
yeah, these days I think you can actually add type annotations in PHP.
I'm sure.
Facebook has a thing as well. So yeah, it's gotten a lot better.
Of course. And
I was writing PHP in the PHP 4 days.
Yeah, me too. Before classes even. Now, when classes came, that was like a big, cool new thing. But yeah, of course, it's also important to remember, like, these languages like JavaScript, PHP, etc., they haven't stopped evolving. Like, you know, these languages are evolving as well. So it's not to say that, you know, this language is bad or this language is good. Like, all the languages are trying to evolve and to solve the problems that people are commonly facing. So I just think that with languages like Swift, Kotlin, like these languages that are very new, very modern, and built specifically mostly for mobile as well, you have some really nice features that are hard to live without now that you're used to them. All right, so that's all the questions that we have time for on this episode. Again, if you want to ask us a question, which we would really love to answer your questions, just tweet it out. You don't have to tweet at any specific account. You just tweet out into the Twitter sphere with the hashtag AskStackTrace in one word. And we'll pick it up and we might answer it on a future episode. But for now, all that remains is for us to thank you so much for listening. And you can find us at StackTracePodcast.fm. You can find Mr. Rambo at _inside on Twitter. And you can find me at JohnSundell on Twitter. But until then, we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.